What is the existing square footage, and what would the resulting square footage be in these units?
Well, it varies, you know, from site plan to site plan. So but it's I would say that it's generous. I don't have a number, you know, on top of my head, but it's rather generous, especially for the studios. You know, the one bedrooms would be regular, you know, one bedrooms, but the studios would definitely be very generous.
And are there samples of two bedrooms, like changing them to two bedrooms?
No. We haven't gotten that far, whether or not that would accommodate. And I think to do a two-bedroom, we would probably have to take a four-bedroom. And, you know, we have fewer of those, and we may get there. The other condition that Andres brought up is that they all have to be a flat. And a lot of some of our stock of townhomes, mm-hmm. upstairs, downstairs, mm-hmm. those don't work. So there's only a certain number that we think we can actually do this with.
Okay.
But I thought that, you know, giving you this layout would really give you a very good idea of how that would work. Because many times we think that, you know, we have so many bedrooms and we can, you know, make it into a bigger place. But the idea was to stay within the envelope, not go, you know, outside, you know, of that, you know, particular, you know, those walls, you know, from that, you know, site.
If you can do this with the planning department, might you think about using Murphy beds for the studios? Or I know there's new style Murphy beds.
Yes,
they're pretty nice. But we don't generally provide furniture. But if the program were specific, we might. But we don't generally provide any furniture.
Yeah, I would still say that, you know, safely the studios would be large enough to accommodate regular furniture. I mean, that's the beauty about it.
Okay.
So to this end and others, I'd like to talk a little bit about the proposed capitalization of some reserves within OPI. As you know, OPI has substantial financial resources, and the lease that HUD has approved between the agency and OPI allows for the agency to instruct OPI to establish reserves in ways that would facilitate its operation as both an owner and developer of affordable housing. So here in the near future, we will be bringing forward a resolution for this board to consider instructing OPI to establish these reserves and also to allow a mechanism for them to be refunded as they're drawn down in the future. So we've got three basic reserves you know, we're going to propose here. The first would be a development reserve, and that's both for the redevelopment of the OPI sites that we've just described, as well as the potential for OPI to conduct other development activities the opportunity presents itself. I think we're going to try and leverage OPI's assets to really push and expand our unit count as much as possible. And of course, you know, cash is absolutely necessary to do that. So we would establish that reserve first. We would also install an operating reserve to ensure that the units that remain in OPI's portfolio have a sufficient amount of cash to operate in the future. We've leaned on an industry standard of 3 months of operating expenses and, if applicable, debt service to fund that reserve. So we'd feel pretty good about having these 1,600 units covered, much in the way that the industry has chosen to cover their reserves for other deals. And finally, we would establish a capital reserve, and this is for improvements to the units and buildings that would not be included in the larger transactions that Andres and I have described here. And so in terms of an amount, we've got an initial target of roughly $80 million. Of that, $60 million would be pointed at the development reserve. $5 million, again, that's 3 months of debt and expenses, would be for the operating reserve, and $15 million would be the capitalized maintenance reserve. And that's roughly equal to 3 years of our typical capital outlay within this portfolio.
And
that's all.
That is. And I would say that the concept of instructing the reserves, we brought in a financial consultant that I respect a lot and have known for many, many years, and he now has a consulting group. He was actually the CFO of the Atlanta Housing Authority for years. We had him read all the disposition, all the land lease documents to come up with the best strategy to enhance and preserve this portfolio. It does cash flow now. It's finally leased up. It's been a really hard road to get there, and I really want to congratulate everybody involved. When we first flipped it, Patricia, right through to Mark and Andreas, who are now making it actually work. So it does have operating receipts, and because it doesn't service debt, it stays in OPI. And if we were to move it back to OHA, and we were to say we want the income, it would actually get clawed back in terms of HUD, and they would reduce it. So we wanted really to look at that issue and how to handle OPI in a way that most benefited the residents and the portfolio and gave it a real purpose other than just the disposing of the section of the public housing program or replacing Section 8. Okay. So turning it into its own development entity is important. We have had in previous budgets or previous audits, you've seen some comments about an interfund balance. HUD does not like interfund balances, and we have a lot of money sitting there on the OHA's side of money that was booked that may be owed, that OPI may owe OHA.
Okay.
But there are other costs that are that they don't, and so we're working through that list in the interfund. But legacy costs, which are retirement for people who worked there 20 years ago, those things are really OHA's responsibility, and they do not need to be repaid by OPI. So we're looking at clearing up the interfund between now and the end of this fiscal year. So Victor's working on that along with Albert to try and map that out based on the guidance that we get from Steve Nolan, who I trust as and has a good perspective on what this portfolio can do. And it was reviewing the documents that Jennifer negotiated the lease with HUD. It took us about 9 months. But in there, it specifically says that OHA should be dictating to OPI exactly what type of reserves and the amounts. Okay. And what we know is this portfolio needs a considerable amount of capital improvements, but most importantly, redevelopment funds to develop it and reach its full potential of more density. So what we're going to come to the board with is to establish those reserves. We may not be anywhere near $80 million right now, but we want to set the goal. And as years go by and it makes more, they'll replenish them. We will be spending it, though, at the same time, because we will have a fairly aggressive perspective on this. The one thing that we did, there are a couple slides we cut on this because of time and everything else. One of them was just the challenges, your challenges slide. Okay. The biggest challenge we feel is really city approval of the increased density in the planning process. So if we can't get over that, then we won't be able to do it.
Yeah.
We'll still have the development fund. We'll still do the new development to the extent we can. Mm-hmm. But in terms of reconfiguring the units into a more viable portfolio and increasing density, we won't. But the timing is perfect for it. You have people talking about putting tough sheds in and even portable buildings behind churches in their parking lot. And really for that neighborhood, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a little increased density here and there scattered throughout the entire city? Our portfolio runs from north to deep east, so it's shared by all.
Yes.
It isn't targeting one neighborhood over another, and then have people, you know, living on the streets or living in campers on the streets and that kind of thing. So it's a solution, and I think it's a solution no one has thought of in the city. They've come up with a million ideas, and everybody's trying to fill theirs. And this one, when Andres showed it to me, it wasn't something that was in my mind, and I think it is a very interesting idea. I think it just needs support from within City Hall, and we're aggressively working on that.
Mm-hmm. Andreas, thank you for this. We have so many people homeless in encampments, and they need to be housed. So one question. In terms of the city approval, what are the challenges there?
Well, we want blanket approvals. Do you want to talk about your proposal, that the number of sites?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, I ran an analysis of all the sites in the OPI portfolio, and I think out of 250 of them, maybe three are zoned to the point where we can increase density. So we're really, per the current zoning, we're at the maximum we could possibly develop without getting additional permission from the city. So, you know, we could go out and we could fight a battle with every neighborhood on each one of these sites one by one, and we would still be talking about doing this in the year 2060. Mm-hmm. You know, it would just take forever for us to get through it. We don't have the staff capacity or, frankly, the time, given the state of the crisis out there, to do that. So what we really want to do is come to them with a slate of reasonable sites. You know, we're not proposing anything that's out of context. And just get them to give us a blanket planning approval all at once. So we can cut that step out and skip straight to the good stuff, which is building housing. And so, you know, that's challenging. I mean, it's challenging to get approval for one site. You know, there's just a climate in California specifically where it's just difficult to get people to build at density. And I think we have to confront that. And hopefully, you know, the environment in the city has changed to the point where people will think a little differently about it. But that's really, that's our hurdle.
Okay. Thank you.
A comment?
Yeah.
Senior Director Kiddo, I want to welcome you to our team.
Thank you.
Yes.
I don't want to say that other folks don't present as well, but the pace that you explain things and the simplicity of your language, I'm just so refreshed because I've always had a hard time understanding our complicated real estate transactions, and I just want to commend you and welcome you to us, because now I'm finally getting it just because of the way that you're explaining it.
Yes.
And I just want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. That's very flattering. And anytime any of you have any questions, my door's open. So, you know, feel free to drop a line.
And I would say this concept of adding OPI for rehab into the baseline tax credit, it makes everything look better, and it gets us rehab units and brand new units in one application. I think it's a great, great concept.
Love it.
Good. Thank you. Well, the whole department does. The whole department has always been an incredible expertise. We've had such talent in that department for so long. It's just I've always had a hard time following along. And you made it just a little bit more easy for me today.
Yes,
and I want to thank you. And thank you, Andres.
Yes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I do have a question. You know, I echo, thank you. These are great ideas, and I'm excited about it.
Yes.
As you go through this, are you thinking that the height, the building heights would stay the same, so they will go higher?
They would. Our typical stock in this portfolio is two stories, you know, and we would probably be pushing 3 to 4, depending on location. It would have to be sensitive to the context, but, you know, if you look around Oakland, most neighborhoods, three stories is not out of line at all. And there are a lot of existing buildings that exceed current zoning and are three stories.
Right.
So, you know, we feel like we've got a pretty good argument there.
And particularly where they're situated. Some are really tucked back a little more, but if we start with the, I think OPI's got to earn its rep.
Okay.
Similar to what OIJ did, that when the first one we do has to be really a benefit to the neighborhood, end up looking great. And I think the corner of 29th and 30th and MLK on MLK it will not only bring a there for the neighborhood, you know, a place where it can be sort of a showcase of a building that will help, but also it can come on the first floor, there can be services, there can be retail. So I think there's an opportunity for the neighborhood there to really help use affordable housing, like in its impact, getting back to our development policy, for a really positive impact on the neighborhood, not only increasing the density and of the residents and also getting the middle income residents beyond even the very low that we'll replace, getting some tax credit income level into it, and maybe something great in the storefront, and even if it's a service provider, because we're always, you know, the space will change that corner, that neighborhood. And I remind folks that even though things have changed now, if you go back to 2013, that was the number one spot for shooting in Oakland, along MLK, between really, you know, 36th or so all the way down to the 20s, that corridor. And that may have changed some, but I think us walking into a place where there's been that history and now displacement going on with a proposal to increase density, to make sure we lock down affordability at the same time and preserve units around it, I think that's really sellable. We're going to have to go out and do our work as OPI. You know, we're going to have to get in front of the neighborhood groups, and that's all of us. You guys all have networks in that neighborhood, too.
Yes.
And getting out ahead of it, if we get permission or when we're getting permission, I think it's going to have to be a really concerted effort the first time out of the gate.
Thank you.
Once you get one, yes. Once you have something you can point to, it changes.
Yes,
and
it does.
You know, people see that
yes,
it was good
it
and it happened and we really did it.
Yes.
And picking that first one, to me, this is the best one, but I may be convinced otherwise by the other folks in the room. But I personally would love to see a brand new three-story, incredible-looking, affordable housing development at 30th and MLK.
Amen.
So I may be a bit Pollyannish. A lot of people accuse me of being Pollyannish. It's okay. But I actually think that there's potential around this to build a really substantial and positive campaign in Oakland, especially at a time when we've been really, I think, pretty divisive around the housing question in Oakland, that there's a potential for actually having some positive advocacy in this space if we play our cards right. And mm-hmm. I think I agree that it's a task that belongs to everyone in terms of building that, but I also think that just how those conversations begin with the community can really set the tone for building a really substantial campaign. And mm-hmm. while I appreciate, Dave, that may look like a really substantial hurdle with respect to the city, I also think that if we play our cards correctly and we're very thoughtful about how to move the conversation, there's a potential for building a really positive groundswell around it.
I speak only for myself, but one of my hopes is that this is a trail that others can follow, because
right.
we need it. Yeah. There's no other way to put it.
You know, I keep thinking that back in the late 60s, whoever was sitting in our chairs mm-hmm. had to fight a battle to get these units built in
yep.
the first place.
Yes.
And they had to get city approval, and they had to go get acquisition. They had to do all that political and neighborhood work. And I think everything that's old is new again. We just get back out there. We did it when we did the disposition itself. Mm-hmm. Now it's going to be kind of a different group, because we want our neighborhood to support us and we want the city to support us. So there's a lot of work ahead, but the time is now to try
yes,
and get these
yes.
approvals. If we
yes.
can't do it in the next, if we can get a blanket approval, even for the first five,
mm-hmm.
we would begin to rock and roll this portfolio
yes.
in a way that people could see very quick results.
So this is my neighborhood, so if you need me to talk to any of the neighborhood groups, just give me a call. I also asked us to consider whether, even though it's more units, is it more people? Because you could fit a lot of folks in a three-bedroom apartment when we have those families, and now we're reducing it to one bedrooms and studios. So it might be more units, but it may not be a lot more people. You know what I'm saying?
You're absolutely. But yeah. The other thing we got to consider is how many, and we had the data, and I could share it when we bring back that disposition, that reserve level ongoing. But we have had, and Michelle Hassan looked at all our wait lists for me, and since 2012, we have over 7,000 single-head households who have not been placed in units because we didn't have the unit size available.
Right.
Think about that. And think about how that contributes to the number of people currently on the street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I completely agree.
Mm. Yeah, I think that Commissioner Griffith was really on point about the narrative around this, because I'm seeing this evolving in a number of ways. For one thing, doing it, proposing it all at once provides an opportunity to show the aggregate impact of the program on housing unit expansion in Oakland. That right there gets attention. But then, because of the scale and the distribution, you know, now it's like, look at how powerful this is, a meaningful effect, but look at how benign it's going to be neighborhood by neighborhood, because this is really spread around, and you know, it's not really it's not really burdening any one area. So there is, you know, I don't know how the narrative would really shape out, but I am just seeing a lot of positive messages to a lot of different stakeholders. You know, because the city can say, look what we have done to solve the housing crisis, you see, and it goes on from, mm-hmm. from you know, and it goes on from mm-hmm. there. So I think this is really cool because, you know, it's another way to add to the stock with, because, you know, one of the issues is there's not really any more land. I mean, there's maybe some, but there's not an abundance of land to scoop up and build housing.
Yeah.
So we're leveraging what we have. And that's another powerful message. Leveraging.
There is. And at some point, and it won't be, I mean, down the road, like 5-10 years, there's going to have to be a real conversation about us exceeding the boundaries of Oakland to do development with our neighboring jurisdiction. Because I think that there's no, we need where the, there's no land in Oakland, is what I just said.
Yeah.
And we're right now can only be in Oakland unless we get a operating agreement with the county.
Yes.
Then we could actually develop into the county as well. And,
wow.
And anyway. Be someone else's challenge, I suppose, but it definitely needs to be discussed at some point. But we still have work to do here, and I think this portfolio alone will keep us busy for a while. And we have some good land in East Oakland to develop as well, one owned by CAHI that will be the developer,
yeah,
and one owned by OHA. So using the affiliates really to their strengths is what this is all about.
We should have bought the Brooklyn Basin stuff.
Well, we got two big lots. I'm happy. And 450 some odd units.
Units, all us.
Dream big.
All right, good. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes, thank you.
So come on up. I think we've got next we have a presentation from Human Resources. We want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges around hiring police officers and what we're doing. So Drew's going to talk a little bit about those. Chief's here as well if we get additional questions, but I'll turn it over to Drew Felder, our Director of Human Resources.
Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Drew Felder. I'm the Director of Human Resources. And this portion of the presentation is going to be in regards to some critical staffing concerns that we have with the Oakland Housing Authority Police Department. And it's going to serve as kind of a precursor to what we're actually going to be bringing forth during the June 4th board meeting. Those items are going to help us address both the obstacles that we have with recruitment and retention that I'm going to go through with you tonight.
Okay. And Drew, if you can move the mic just a little closer, it'll pick up better.
What about now?
That's good.
Excellent. Okay, so on this first slide, this speaks to budgeted staffing. And on the left-hand side, you can see the actual budgeted numbers. And on the right are the actual employees that are in the positions. So out of the 34 sworn officers that we have, 25 of them are actually the police officer job description, which is our entry officer sworn position. Out of the 25 that we have budgeted, only 16 are currently filled. So that's significant in and of itself. But when you think about the fact that our employees have to go on medical leaves, potentially go on vacation, take time off, you know, that will at any given time reduce that number even lower. For instance, during the month of May, there are two officers that I know of that will be on a leave for approximately 30 days. So that automatically takes our number down from 16 to 14, which is really stretching our officers very thinly. So this slide shows the history of our recruitment and retention over the past 18 years. So this is going all the way back to January 1st of 2000. And as you can see, we've hired 56 officers, but we've only managed to retain 19 of them. That's very significant. There's obviously going to be some attrition due to retirements, resignations, things of that nature. But if you look all the way over on the right-hand side, that speaks to lateral resignation. So that means an officer is leaving our agency and going to another law enforcement agency. Okay. So if you look at this chart here, this actually shows in the yellow that 38% of our officers that we brought on in the past 18 years have gone to outside law enforcement, and we've only managed to retain 34%. So if you think about that, we've actually lost more officers to other agencies than we've been able to keep. So this slide speaks to exactly why that is. And if you look at this is a breakdown of several different items, but it can be summarized into three different sections. The first is that there are fewer people entering the actual police academies, which reduces the entire pool of applicants for all law enforcement agencies in the region. So that's not just us. That includes OPD, SFPD, everyone else. And even out of those applicants that go into the academy, not all of them are able to pass the background checks. So that means people may have issues with credit, drug abuse, any type of criminal history. Those things will actually preclude them from being able to continue through the academy to graduate to become officers.
Credit?
Yes, that's actually part of the background check. In addition, so out of the four agencies listed here, which are Oakland Police Department, the BART Police Department, Oakland Unified School District, and OHAPD, there are 130 vacancies right now. And that's just between those four departments. So that's not counting any of the other neighboring municipalities like Livermore, Pleasanton, SFPD, any of those groups. And they're all kind of vying for the same base of people. So given that we have fewer people applying and we also have more vacancies, on top of those two things, OHAPD gross pay and total compensation doesn't compare favorably with other agencies in the region. And then recently we did a salary survey that showed that we were in the bottom approximately 30% of the agencies, and it's not, that's actually including agencies that our officers are leaving to go to. So if you would take it into account some of the other municipalities, things of that nature, our percentages are very, very low compared to them. So basically, we're in a market where we are competing with agencies that pay much, much more than we do. Okay. So in addition to that issue, this slide essentially shows something that a lot of people don't think about when it comes to law enforcement recruitment. So if you look on the OHAPD side of the scale, we're able to recruit from internal personnel and from police academies. And essentially the way that works is that we can encourage our own internal non-sworn officers to go through a police academy, and we can basically recruit non-affiliated members of police academies, which means that they aren't already associated with another law enforcement agency. So those are really the only two groups that we can recruit from. When you look at all the law enforcement agencies, they can recruit from almost anywhere, churches, colleges, military, ex-military, and other police academies, because they actually have a program which allows them to bring in employees as a recruit. So that doesn't mean they come on board as an officer. They come on board as a trainee, and then they are paid to go through the police academy, and when they come out, they become a police officer. So that allows them to have a better conduit to bring people from the general public on board.
Oh, I see, and we can't do that here. We're not set up for that.
Not yet.
Okay.
But in regards to solutions, that's actually one of the things that we're looking at right now, and we're most of the way through finalizing a program that will allow us to have that same type of onboarding, which would mean that we'd be able to hire someone as a police trainee, put them through the academy, and have them attached to us as an actual police officer once they graduate. So that'll allow us to broaden our horizons as far as who we can actually go and recruit towards. So that means we could go to high schools, colleges, things of that nature, and be able to increase at least the number of applicants that we get in. So even if we have issues with people passing the background checks or whatnot, we'll be looking from a larger group. For instance, OPD, their most recent academy had about 33 applicants, and only 11 of them were able to make it through. So we have a difficulty in getting people to even go through the academy. So we have to make sure that we do as much as we can up front to get as many people as we can into the academy so that we have a higher likelihood of getting people all the way through to the end to have them become officers. Okay. Now, the other big issue, and this is what I talked about earlier that will have to be brought before the board on June 4th, is a cost-sharing program. And what this program is going to allow us to do is increase the gross total compensation of our officers while not costing the agency as much as just generally increasing their pay. And in a nutshell, what this is that our more senior officers are going to be contributing to what everyone else has to pay in our sworn officer group towards their pension. And even for us to be talking about this, we had to have a vote beforehand, which required 51% of the affected employees to pass it. And actually, I'm very happy to say 100% of them are in favor of this. And the word has been apparently spreading about this because some of the officers that we have recently lost to lateral transfers have already expressed interest in coming back. because they've told us that the only reason that they really left in the first place was just because of the compensation, and that they missed the camaraderie and the way that they were able to interact with residents and whatnot. And I'm also happy to say that we might be able to reinstate one of them as soon as June to get somebody back back on the street and back in patrolling, which I'm very, very happy about. So with these two things, these will both be able to address our issues with recruitment and our issues with retention. And I'm hoping that moving forward, that we will be able to see a reduction in the vacancies as soon as the end of this year. And given that we have one person coming back already, by my projections, if we're able to do this properly, we might be able to get fully staffed in the next 24 months. Are there any questions?
And there will be, to change the benefit, there will be a resolution that CalPERS requires, similar to what we do when all the MOUs come forward to change, and that'll be probably June 4th is what we're trying to get it done so we can implement it right away. And it changes the percentage, and the board report will probably, will explain more clearly how that works. For it, but it, we have an analysis of every single officer. They know where they are. We've met with them, and they know what it does. Some people increase, some people you know, on the higher end who've been here longer actually lose some money, but they bought into it because they know it benefits the younger officers.
Absolutely. I'm curious what we know about the folks who have made the lateral moves other than the desire for higher pay.
So as far as what their reasonings were for leaving, so there's been two reasons. The most prominent one has been just I want to make more money. I feel like I'm not compensated as well as some of the other officers at other agencies are. And another piece is the location. So in some positions, they've been closer to home.
Yeah. Let me follow up with that also. The one particular officer who left, it's he really wanted to work in the city that he grew up in, one that recently left us, you know, and I did understand that, but compensation has a lot to do with it, especially with officers driving 3 hours to and from work. It really takes a toll on them, you know, not to be able to commute for so long and to be able to have a higher compensation package elsewhere. I would have to say that other than maybe about four of the officers who have left, they thoroughly enjoyed where they work, and a lot of them, they stay in contact. At first, when they get out of the academy and we recruit from, let's face it, and I was in the same boat. I did not set out to be a housing authority police officer. I started the sheriff's office, and I bought into the 911 system, and when I came to the housing authority, and I came because I didn't want to work in the jail. They were going to send me there for 7 years, and that was not part of my path. But I bought into the fact of being able to help residents and to be able to really solve a problem, to be able to actually define a goal and to state how we achieved it. And every one of our officers who are here can say that. They can do exactly that. And they have bought into that concept. But nevertheless, you know, they still deserve and they want to be compensated the same as others and also to have that high quality of life. So I cannot say 100% for all of them. I will say the majority of them, that is the issue. For a lot of them, it's still, if you want to be a homicide detective, you have to go to OPD. If you want to ride motors and motorcycles, you're going to have to go somewhere else. You're just not going to do that here. But again, I would say at least 60% of them, they have bought into the concept. They have enjoyed working here, and they want to be here. Mm-hmm. And this will help. This will help drastically. We're still going to run into a lot of the same issues when it comes down to recruiting people. But I, you know, Ms. Castillo said it best when we had our police dispatchers up, and when she left, she said she liked to see the diversity. Well, how do I do that unless we also change the strategies? Because let's face it, when we got to these academies, and right now, for the non-affiliates from every academy from Napa to Fresno, there's only 57 non-affiliates. Of those, only 7 of them are minority and female, 3 of them are female. Our population is about 69% African Americans. How do I achieve racial composition within our ranks and to explore the fact of even becoming more to our interest within the Housing Authority of getting female applicants. I cannot get close to that unless I get to the recruiting pool to begin looking specifically at those people to bring in. And we need females and we need minorities.
Yes.
We absolutely need them, and we need them with our work rate. We have to represent our population. Yes. And it has become impossible for us to do it. And when I do achieve those ranks, well, guess what? A black female is very valuable to the Richmond Police Department, and that's where they're going. I've lost two of them to OPD, one to Richmond. And we just can't keep up. This is going to help. This is going to help drastically.
Okay. Is this going to be enough?
Absolutely.
Cool. All right.
Absolutely. And we did it in a way that we pretty much went cost neutral.
Cool.
We went cost neutral.
That's even better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. That was one of my questions, cost neutral. So the recruiting applicant pool, we are now going to just be reaching out to the other. I don't understand why we weren't doing that from the beginning.
Well, the problem when you're at a lower salary is you have San Francisco PD and you have others. If I was to have gone out and did recruits and put them through the academy, there's no way they would be there.
Yes.
East Bay Regional Parks Police is the second lowest. They were just below us. Mm-hmm. We'll surpass them and most others, with this. So we won't have that issue. But in our county chief's meeting, the chief was bragging about, seven people in the Alameda County Academy, and he's so happy. First time in 14 years he was going to beat 100%. He came to the next meeting and said the San Francisco PD gave four of those people a check to give them to repay the academy costs and stole four of them right from the academy.
That was
my issue. Why it wasn't a fact of something that we couldn't do.
Right.
But it did not make sense to us to even consider doing something like that when we knew they would never make it to an academy. Somebody was going to come steal these officers. Mm-hmm. And Eric will tell you that Ann Kirkpatrick already said she was going to try to steal as many as she could.
She told me that personally.
My second question has to do with the terminations. Are there strategies in place to reduce those, the terminations?
Well,
21%.
Well, I mean, there are probably two answers to that question. I mean, yes and no. You're right. You're absolutely correct. A lot of the terminations were mainly, people just can't make the training program. Mm-hmm. Being a police officer is like having a license. We have state mandated things we have to do, trainings we have to complete. And through those trainings, through our field training program, we most certainly have to make sure that people can do the things they need. Struggle with report writing. They struggle with diversity. They struggle in a lot of different areas, when it comes down to law enforcement. And the one thing we never want to do is have the wrong person in this environment. And sometimes they're just better suited to be in Livermore and not Oakland because we want the right person. Now, the other part of it, I cannot help. I have zero tolerance for misconduct. Mm-hmm. And I really will not budge on that. I will terminate you if you do the wrong thing. Yeah. I mean, Charlie Plummer called him the seven deadly sins. He's right. Mm-hmm. He's right, and that's the one thing we don't need. Nobody's coming to this board and complaining about a Housing Authority officer. We'll keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. But I do think the reason, of course, the captain – Patrick wants to steal the officers, and she'll tell you is because we actually know what community policing means.
Right.
So, two questions. Credit reporting. Credit reporting.
Oh, police officers have a much more rigorous hiring process than any other employee in the state. And that is only, they go through a formal assessment as well as, and you can go talk more about it. But, and I would tell you from my standpoint, when I get the rec and the chief will tell you, to hit approve isn't just an automatic thing. I mean, I really do look at them and I often question because it's, to me, it's one of the most serious hires you'll make. You're giving someone a police badge, a gun, and an authority to go into the community. And so it's hard. And I would say the other thing that maybe James Williams is here, the captain, will chime in on is that our police department actually prefers to have people who are real rookies and not coming from other departments so that they can make sure they get trained correctly and they make sure they have the right culture that matches our department.
Sure. Captain Williams from the Housing Authority Police Department. I could speak on the credit reporting aspect.
Thank you.
The state, California State Peace Officer Standard and Training sets guidelines that you should consider when you're hiring a police officer. One of the guidelines is the credit report. Since I've been here, we have never disqualified someone based on their credit report. But what the credit report does, it shows just a basic pattern of your life. So if we get someone that has a low credit score or a bad credit report, and they've also been terminated for three different jobs, the neighbors say they're a bad neighbor. We go and speak to two different previous relationship partners they've been in, said that the person was, you know, verbally abusive. It sets that pattern that this person might not be a good fit. So it's just a consideration that we have to look at, that the state mandates that it's there. So, but no one's ever been just outright released for a credit report.
Okay. The second question, going into the colleges, do we anticipate doing that, connecting with the colleges?
Sure. So we're hoping when we get this new plan in place that we want to go. We've already had this discussion amongst our staff and our recruit. We have an actual recruitment team that we're going to be putting in place, that we've already set training with this recruitment team as to what our strategy is going to be. Colleges are one of the first things on our strategy. We're looking at going to Laney. We're looking at going to Merritt. We're looking at reaching out to the criminal justice program at Merritt. But we're also looking at just going to Cal State East Bay and to some of the other non-traditional law enforcement places just to find people that match our demographics.
It's also part of the reason we have a cadet and an explorer program to make sure even younger we get people engaged.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. I just want to know, how many, have you ever reached the goal? How many officers do you have? The officers?
We've been fully staffed since I've been here.
What's the staff?
Yeah, once.
How many?
Only at one time during our history have we been fully staffed. Mm-hmm. It was just 34.
Yeah. Okay. So have you ever had a police, an academy? Have you considered an academy?
We can't operate one. But what we could do, which has been fielded, is sponsor people into the academy, correct?
Okay. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Do people pay their own way through an academy? So would a loan program? Is that what you're...
So right now, people pay their own way through the academy, and then we pick them up to hire them. With this new proposal, what we're hoping to do is we would pay that person's tuition to go through the academy. They would actually be an employee.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, it's an entirely new job spec.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And for the cadets, is there a planned path for them?
No, a lot of them want to get involved in criminal justice. That could become an attorney, a district attorney. There's many, many roads, and you never want to restrict them in any way. What they get exposed to, though, I think, is policies, procedures, and kind of the discipline of the law enforcement in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. It helps, I think, with the kids, and some of them are kids, in terms of their kind of growth and development. But it also, there's been several that I know of, and you guys know them much better than I ever will, that tell me that they want to go into this. And it's usually around law, legal, district attorney stuff.
Our cadet program is set up as an education program. We could care less if the people that go through it want to actually become police officers involved in law enforcement. What we care is that person gets an education, they possibly get a degree, and that they just become a productive member of society. And then if we could help them do that, great.
Awesome. So last question, how many of our officers have long commutes? Mm-hmm. Are most of them cannot afford to live in Oakland? That's an issue tied with the compensation?
It is, absolutely, and the drive is an issue. And we do have a program within OPI where we actually have officers living in OPI units in different areas of the city, and particularly problem sites. It gets us two things. One is it gets the officers living in the community, which I think is really important, because they're driving an OHA vehicle and parking on OHA parking spot, they can actually take vehicles home, which helps neighborhoods and has helped significantly some of the problem streets that we have in Oakland just going home. So we have a certain number of units that we allocate, and there's a process for it for some employees of the police department for the officers to live in the community. And I think that what grew out of, not in small part, of long commutes or people not being able to afford to live here.
Okay.
I'm not sure the total amount.
There's only six. So, like, for long commutes, I would say just a handful, about five or six.
Oh, but how many units?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just read the memo, but I don't remember.
Six.
Six. I'm right. We what we really did is say, in theory, we want to take one unit in each one of the six amps in OP is the idea.
Okay.
We sometimes miss, but we're close. You know, there may be two in one amp and none next door, but they're close. Yeah, and their families, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they become part of the neighborhood, which is great.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you. Oh, and the officers do pay rent, by the way, just a reduced rent. Give them a little break on the rent. So the next part is actually the discussion of running down the budget. This is very similar to what you get every year. The budget this year was done by a new team, and Carolyn Barnett went over to leased housing, and we turned it over, and Victor drove it along with Albert Chang, who's going to sit down, and Vicki Cullen, and I would say they did an outstanding job of getting this through, and we've had some smooth budget years, but this one was particularly well-run and smooth because of the team sitting in front of you, and you have my gratitude.
They made
adequate use of their time and my time, and we got through it really in a very thoughtful and good way. Particularly, I think Vicki was responsible for getting the meeting scheduled, getting the things coordinated, getting the roll-up, and it's rough to do. This is a huge budget, $970 million, and you've seen just a piece of what goes into it. So the brains behind it are sitting before you, and I will turn it over to Victor first to walk you through what you have in the packet. Do you want me to do that first, Victor? So this is this first document is OPI and CAHI, and it's year over year of the whole bit and the variance, which is similar. The first fold-out document you get is OHA and the affiliates, because these won't come back to the board. It'll be just OHA when we do the board resolution. And then the second fold-out is just OHA, so this is what goes to the board. And then we always include a summary of staffing for the number of positions we're including in the budget, and this year, again, it's staying flat at 371, which is kind of my goal, because we have a lot of, we may move people, but I don't think we necessarily need additional staffing at this point. So that's what's in the packet, and we're going to turn it over for the PowerPoint and walk it through, and the PowerPoint includes highlights from what I just told you, so you'll want us to turn to the right handout when you get to it.
Again, good evening, commissioners. I want to introduce my budget team and new budget team for this year. Albert Chang, accounting officer 3, Vicki Cullen, accounting officer 2, and myself, Victor Madama, the director of finance. Special thanks to Carolyn Barnett and Jonathan Young, who guided us and assisted us in, you know, from the previous...
Raise your hand.
Thank you. Thank
previous
you.
Previous staff who used to do the budget previous years, so they were really helpful to my staff as well. So want to focus on the PowerPoint slides. PowerPoint slides is related to the OHA roll-up budget. We'll try to keep the presentation brief. Fiscal year 19 budget has four major revenue sources. One of them is the MTW single fund. As you can see on the PowerPoint, the MTW single fund source of revenue includes housing choice vouchers, funding, capital fund grant, blocked, and the public housing operating subsidy. Those are our major revenue sources, as you've seen in most of the documents that you've looked at tonight. And the second bucket is the housing revenue. Housing revenue includes tenant rent, other miscellaneous tenant income like laundry, cleaning fee, maintenance charges, and the third major third sources of funds is other revenue. Other revenue includes investment income, developer fees, leases, and
grants
is up there. But anyway, other revenue includes miscellaneous other income, which is security, landlord initiatives, and some non-federal money that we received. And the last bucket for our revenue sources is internal charges and revenue. These are, as explained in the past, these are internal transfers between departments that are not revenue generating departments, and it's transferred to the from revenue generating departments, allocated some of the costs, and that's where the those transfers come from. Our total income that's presented in front of you is about $282,370,438. Going to the next slide.
And this one, if we're going to pull up the sheet, matches the OHA excluding affiliates, because that's the slide capture. And if you go to the one with affiliates, the figure changes and it'll be larger because it includes OPI and CAHI. Okay? So the one that these slides are based off of is the big holdout that says excluding affiliates. Okay. So it's only OHA.
Excluding affiliates.
Excluding.
Yes. Not included. I think it's the second one in your packet.
The next slide is called budget snapshot. It tells you how our revenue is broken out, starting from the housing revenue bucket, as you saw in the first page, of the thing which includes tenant income, other tenant income, laundry, vending, cleaning fee, and the net tenant income for budget 19 that we projected is $4.7 million. Going down, the MTW bucket, which is the major source of funding, subsidies, the HAP, HCBs, what's it called? I'm sorry.
And capital grants.
Yeah, capital grants, grant income for Job Plus, FSS, Ross, and capital fund grants. I think Eric spoke to that earlier, obligating those funds. A total grant income for 2019 fiscal year is $256 million.
And within that list, they're not all what we call fungible. So it's not all of those are MTW dollars, only a portion are fungible. Other government grants aren't. The Section 8 HVZ subsidy, those are traditional programs like BASH, Mainstream Family Unification. Those are not fungible under MTW. So it isn't that we have all this money. Some of it's very targeted and limited.
Going through down the list there, other revenue, as I mentioned earlier, other revenue consists of investment income. Mainly it's the note that we hold. I think it's the Ave Vista property. We have a note there that we're getting some investment income, fraud recovery, ground leases and all, et cetera. And then internal transfers, which totals to $21,600,000. For a total income inflow from operations of $282 million. So those are our revenue sources. We'll go to the next slide, functional expenses, and I'll let Alder Chang walk you through it.
Yeah, on the functional expenses category, there are essentially four different areas. On the functional expenses area, there are essentially four different areas. This administration function is primarily consists of salaries, fees from banking fees, and then other office related expenses. The bulk of the administrative expenses essentially is primarily from salaries and benefits that we pay for administrative support. The other area of functional expenses that we incur for the fiscal year 19 budget is in the tenant services and maintenance operational area. Again, salaries and benefits is one of the major expenses that's incurred for tenant services and maintenance and operations. The other component that's made up of the expenses in that area is materials and contract expenses. That essentially is the material costs and the salaries and the contract costs that we incur in terms of rehabbing the buildings for a lot of the sites. The third area is in utilities, and that primarily consists of electricity, gas, and water that we pay for the different properties. The third area of functional area of expenses that that we incur is in the protective service and general expenses area. And again, the primary expenses in the category is in salaries and in benefits. Insurance and also other general expenses such as workman's comp and also expenses from subsidies that we pay our mixed finance low rent public housing sites. And the third and the fourth area in the functional expense category is in the rehab and housing assistance payments category. And the bulk of that is essentially HAP payments that we made out to in the lease housing group. Again, salary and benefit is also one of the costs that will incur in that area, and also rehab costs for some of the OP sites that we pay for on behalf of OP. And the next slide, what I'm going to do, this basically is a budget snapshot of the total expenses within each of those functional area. Under total administrative expenses, we are budgeting for fiscal year 19, roughly $43.5 million. A bulk of it is in salaries and benefits. And on the next slide, under tenant services and utilities, you'll see tenant services is roughly $2.5 million for fiscal year 19. Bulk of it is in salaries and also in programs expenses such as expenses incurred for child and youth programs, employment programs, and civil engagement programs.
And just to make a note that the year over year with the variance will give you an idea of how some of the money has changed. That's a 25% increase over last year for tenant services. It's on the smaller one.
And this one,
yeah. You can follow on either one, but yeah.
And total for utility expenses runs roughly about $2 million.
Oh, nice.
Essentially, it's made out of water, electricity, and gas for fiscal year 19. And as far as total maintenance expenses, runs around $10.5 million for fiscal year 19. Again, salaries is a bulk of that made up that expenses.
And that's just a 3% decline where if you look at the year over year on page 7 at the top. That dark blue line adds it all up, and you can see.
And in the general expenses category, we're looking at roughly about $5 million budgeted for fiscal year 19, and the bulk of it is in workman's comp and also other general expenses. As I mentioned, the other general expenses primarily consist of the subsidies that we pay out to the mixed finance low-rent public housing sites.
And that's a 16% reduction over last year's budget. For okay. those costs. Now, I would say that most of that has to do with us getting more accurate at predicting.
Yeah.
But it is some reduction.
Okay.
Total protective services expenses for fiscal year 19 is budgeted at roughly about $6.5 million. Mm-hmm. Most of it essentially goes to salaries and benefits for the protective services employees. Then we have the housing assistance payments, roughly $202 million. Most of it is in HAP, which is $191 million.
Okay.
We have the other sponsor-based program that we pay roughly $5 million, which we discussed in previously. That's essentially the SROs and the...
And the new programs.
And the new programs, yeah. Then lastly, we have the non-operating part. That's essentially made up of the allocation expenses that one department allocate to the other, plus $1 million of extraordinary expenses that's incurred by OHA on behalf of the rehab work that we are doing for OB. The next slide, essentially, it's just a different way of looking at the spread of expenses by cost centers.
And this has to do with the cost allocation plan and how we've gone over on several years that how we allocate money and it goes in and out and it can be a little confusing. So I think it's worth always just going over a few slides explaining how we take our central office costs, which is what we're talking about, the cost center, and how we make the programs actually reimburse the central office departments.
Okay.
Yes. So the central office costs, our central office cost center essentially is made up of the finance group, the IT group, the executive office, the office of program operations, HR, and procurement. Then in the cost center, security and development, it's essentially made out of the police department, the real estate and development group. And the internal services center essentially is made out of the CID group, or capital improvement and development group, property management group, and asset management group. Then the site and program expenses, or the cost centers, actually the site and program expenses area actually is a cost center and a profit center, because they do generate revenue at those sites. It's essentially made out of the low-rent public housing sites, lease housing, FCP, and we show OP there because of the cost that we incur in support of OP.
So in other words, that's just OHA's costs related to OP. It's not the administration of OP. And as time goes by, it'll be more separate.
Okay.
And to a point where it may change what that nonprofit is as it gets its own reality and identity. The other thing I was going to mention, we did make one change, big change, and maybe when we walk through this, I'll talk about it afterwards. And this is some advice, again, from Steve Nolan about how to book the police department in FCP. It had been in previous years allocated out. We actually are going to, it's part of it, for years we paid it just directly with MTW funds. And then we sort of moved the funds and had OP pay their share and OHA pay theirs. On his advice, we should go back to having it be an MTW activity expense and let HUD pay for it through MTW funds directly. Yes. So that will be going on in the new fiscal year. Go on, Albert. Thank you. Sorry.
The next slide, I will let Vicki present.
Thank you, Albert. Vicki Colon, accounting officer 2 in the fabulous finance department. Our next slide is a review of the layout of the agency-wide budget. And so we start with the general ledger account number. The next column is the account description. Our third column is the total column. So those are the numbers that are being presented to you for your review and approval. Next, we go to the service providing departments, beginning with the central office cost center. And again,
I think if you click the thing, it'll point down to what she's saying.
Thank you. Nice. Thank you. Okay, so we're on central office cost center. So that includes the executive office, legal, finance. Then we go to security and development. And that includes the police department and the Office of Real Estate Development. Next, family and community partnerships. And then property management. And so property management is where we budget the administrative staff for the Office of Property Operations. Next is asset management. And that's where we budget the administrative staff that oversees the third-party managed sites. Next, we have capital improvement department and facilities, so the seven buildings, the administrative buildings. The last four columns are the revenue-generating departments. And so we start with the all public housing properties, so that also includes the third-party managed properties. Next, we have HAP and non-HAP. So that's the housing assistance payments. And so these two columns together are the leased housing department. The HAP column has the HCV subsidies in and the HAP payments out. And then the non-HAP is comprised of all of the administrative costs for the leased housing department. So since the HAP is such a large number and then the subsidy is an in and an out, we have these separated on the budget. And finally...
Just one quick note, that non-HAP, for whatever reason, is actually some of the non-MTW. So you have Section 8 HCV subsidy, and you have the admin fee that we receive from HUD. The admin fee is roughly $18 million. The subsidy is $24 million if you look at the list. And that's... So it does include... And that when we say Section 8 admin fee income, I think... Or I'm sorry, HCV, that's VASH, Mainstream, FUP, those programs, which are in a separate column than the HAP, which is only MTW and fungible.
And finally, the non-federal section of the budget, and that's for our non-MTW activities. And so this next slide is an illustration of the allocation process. And again, it's a way that the costs for the different budget areas are distributed to the other departments. So at the top, we have the central office cost center, and those costs are distributed down to the other departments shown here. And again, as Mr. Johnson mentioned, security will not be allocated on, but the costs are distributed down to the internal service centers, and that includes family and community partnerships and also the capital improvement department. And then finally, costs are further allocated to the site and program areas. And so that would be leased housing, public housing, all the AMPs, all the properties. So this last slide you will find on the last page of the roll-up. And so these are the total numbers listed here as the budget summary. So we start with the total revenue of $282 million, total expenses of $286 million. And we have an excess of expenses over revenue of $3.7 million, capital outlay of $63 million, retirees medical, $1.6 million. So our total expenses, including capital and the retirees medical, is $351 million. We have an excess of expenses over revenue of $69 million. But after the transfer in, the MTW transfer from reserves of $68.5 million, we have net income, actually it's a deficit of $524,000, but that's actually in the non-federal column. So non-federal has enough money to cover if we were to go ahead and conduct all the activities on the budget, but we do not transfer MTW funds, and the whole point is to keep them separated. So that's why you show that net income there.
Can we stop right there just for clarification? Thank you, Chair. I just want to understand this page a little bit better. What is capital outlay? And then can you explain the MTW transfer in from reserves?
Yes, so the capital outlay, those are all of the capital expenditures. So it includes several of the projects that we were seeing in the Office of Real Estate Development,
Mr. Kiddo's group.
But Dave mentioned $58 million worth of
It's all the development projects, and also the capital outlay would be capital improvements in in the budget for any public housing units that are being rehabbed, the Elk Groves, the Empyrean, any property acquisition, Foothill Family Apartments, 15th and Harrison, and upstairs.
So that's the total amount of all the development plans that we have in place?
Yes, and also some unit rehabs and things that go on in the within the capital fund, which funds capital improvements to any public housing site. So there's money budgeted for almost every public housing site as well, correct?
And this is, yes, just for me, it's including the OPI and the CAPI stuff?
Not this number.
This is just OHA.
Just OHA.
Yeah, and the other projects are the Harrison renovations here, IT upgrades. We have other renovations to major repairs of 3.4. That's the amount that's being put into public housing units this year. And then we budgeted 1.6 for OPEB and retirement medical benefits as well. So on the sheet, and we handed it out, this sheet, you can see where it actually is.
Okay.
All the details
and
right
then
there.
When we transfer in from the reserves.
Those are HUD-held reserves.
HUD-held reserves.
That are available to us to expend.
Okay.
And
so we're bringing them in this
yeah,
we're, in the
we're,
next fiscal
we're planning,
year.
We're committing them and obligating them to specific projects.
Okay.
Yeah, and we want to actually show how we're going to use them. If you look at, by the way, the handout, this one, the one sheet we put, which is an analysis of how much HUD-held reserves we have, what we're committing them for, and this is the one that says.
Confidential.
Yep. It lists our projects, how much we're budgeting or anticipating going into negotiations with, how we're spending it. It gets you down to a balance of $58 million worth of HUD, worth of unobligated funds that are available. We have to hold operating reserves out of that.
Okay.
So you have $58 million if we were what is considered among the MTW group as a reasonable safe harbor is to have 4 months of operating expenses and then 2 months of HAP. So 4 months of what it costs all of us, it costs to operate us, keep our sites running, pay the water bills, the electric and all that, and then 2 months of housing assistance payments. The 2 months really grows out of sequestration in 2013 when we realized that we wouldn't have access to some funds to pay HAP. And that gets you, those two things are on the list, and that's a total of 48. And that leaves us, if we take all these costs into consideration, the amount of HUD-held funds remaining are $10 million that we have to allocate to something.
Okay.
We're
leaving $10 million kind of
HUD-held. HUD-held.
We're leaving that there.
HUD now holds all our reserves.
Right. But we're pulling this back, right?
We're drawing it down.
Drawing it down.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a good plan.
It does include, I want to just point out, it does include a large chunk, $3 million for other buyouts, and that could be Mandela Gateway,
okay,
Chestnut Linden, which are upcoming, and we want to make sure we have resources available to negotiate those buyouts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And particularly the Mandela, I think, may be challenging in conversations with Bridge.
I felt like I heard $7 million reserved for possible.
$7 million is property acquisition.
Property
That's
acquisition.
Different.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
The buyouts are three. It's a total of 10.
Okay.
Buyouts are three. Property acquisition, so we've given Dave $7 million to go look at property this year, basically, in the budget.
Yep.
All right. In this real estate market, Godspeed.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can come up with. But we want to be ready. We always want to have some funds earmarked
sure.
for that.
Absolutely.
If the market were to change, if something comes on the market, like on Harrison Street that we're interested in, that we think
yes.
would work, or if something comes on the market, a deal we want to get involved in, like Brooklyn, we want to be able to have the funds there.
Yes.
And be able to move something to the board and make it happen. I also think it's really important for us every year to be able to tell HUD what our reserves are committed or obligated
yes.
for.
Absolutely.
I don't want them to get under the impression that, oh, they don't need it for 15th and Harrison or the Oak Groves and sweep it back. This is making a commitment, an obligation is when you sign a contract.
Right.
Thank you.
So I actually have a question here. On this $48 million here, does HUD recognize that as a as a valid number, and they're not going to sweep it, or is there some question around that?
There are some questions around it. The question comes twofold. We were, you know, we went into many years of negotiation regarding our contract, and there were changes to it, and this came up. But if you remember, in the end of the day, we were able to get a current extension to our current agreement. So yeah, we believe we are completely within the legal contractual rights under the MTW agreement to maintain adequate reserve levels under that agreement, and we have the authority to do so. And no one at HUD is talking about that specifically. What they are talking about is that MTW agencies have reserves and nobody else does, basically. Our amount of reserves for the 39 agencies are almost as much as the rest of the housing authorities combined.
Wow.
And we, in Oakland, are one of the agencies that have a large reserve holding. But we have plans for ours, and we that. And so and I've explained this, and by the way, during negotiations, Dominic Blum, who's currently the acting Assistant Secretary for Public and Indian Housing, that used to run the MTW program and development in Hope 6, understands development better than anyone in the building, which is a joy, because when we're talking about reserves, I explained to them, and this can be repeated to the world very loudly, that I cannot come to the board and say, I want to do this deal for Brooklyn Basin for $10 million if I don't have $10 million in the bank. Yes. I can't say, in the next 3 years, I promise I'm going to come up with $10 million in savings. You need to have it. It would be negligent, if not fraudulent, for this board and me to propose spending money we don't have.
Yes.
So we have to have money banked in the reserves.
Yes.
Sometimes the reserve levels can look high, but why I always like to do the budget into this is you get to see where how quickly you get to that that amount.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot. And when it comes back even at 10 million, I'm getting like a little bit wondering if maybe that's maybe too low. In the past, it's been higher. And and what I would also point out in terms of the what we're expending, because we spend money. So last year, in terms of the amount that we were depending on reserves, it's a 27% drop over last year because it included things like acquisition of Brooklyn Basin, which has already taken place, so that money went out, and we expended it in other projects. So it really is based on what comes to fruition in that year. Sometimes these funds will be rolled over to a future year, but they're committed by the board that these are funds we want to use to, you know, for the Oak Groves, for Foothill and Harrison, for Foothill Family, for repositioning, for doing buyouts, for doing the Empyrean deal. We need to, even if the Empyrean deal were to get delayed and we weren't going to write the $3.5 million check this year, we would roll that forward in next year. But from HUD's perspective, it would stay committed to that project here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. It gets odd, so I sometimes can go off. I don't mean to.
Well, I had a second part to the question about the $48 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say we bump into some just wow type of opportunity, and could we use that money, or would that cause us trouble?
Yes, and what we consider those, and if you can look on the list, we consider those safe harbors. I mean, if we maintain this amount, I think the board can, in great confidence, know we're going to stay solvent, we're going to be able to see through any crisis. Should we want to come down, and HUD would argue 1 month, by the way, should we come down for 1 month, I would tell you it's dangerous, but it's a risk based on the, you know, that we might want to take if a deal comes up.
Yeah, I got it. Okay, good. That's what I wanted to know. Very cool.
I have a question. How long did it take to build up the reserves to the $123 million?
We've been in this program now. We joined it in 2004, so 14 years. Every year it gets better. It's kind of it's a flywheel concept that you once you get development going, once you have more programs, once like each year we do better at serving more people, and we serve a chunk of more people without having monthly federal housing assistance because of the tax credit units. So we get credit for serving people, and that throws off more income because we're not using it for HAP.
Yes.
And we choose to lease up. And the other thing we do here, and it's unique to Oakland in terms of the MTW agencies, is we always, and this is true way before MTW, our Section 8 program always operated at a lower HAP than the region. So the amount of rent in Oakland was always and traditionally lower than the region. So that HUD funds you at this level based on the area, and we weren't spending quite that. So because our HAP was less, some of it is because of the market, and some of it's because our residents work. So we have, you know, we have a good percentage of earned income. So they pay more of a portion. Before MTW, at the end of the year, there's the year-end reconciliation. That's where they come in and they take all that money back. Oh, you didn't use it for HAP because tenants were working, we get it back. What MTW does is not have a year-end reconciliation. Mm-hmm. The funds remain available to this agency to program the way that we want. So that's why we are able to do the reserves. And every year we've had more, and during the most of the development period over the past 5 years has been funded through asset through replacement housing factor funds, which became DDTF, what is it, Jonathan? Development Disposition Transition Funding. And we've been blessed with that.
Yes.
So we have had $6-point-some-odd million a year coming into the agency for development that we wouldn't have otherwise had we not done the disposition with OPI. Now, you could argue if HUD really understood how some of this worked, I'm not sure that they would. Someone's going to figure it out. But in the meantime.
But so far.
In the meantime, for example, when we say we're booking capital fund and at $6.5 million this year, more than half of that is DDTF, the new acronym. It used to be replacement housing factor funds. Under that rule, you get 5 years. And then this is the old rule. And then replacement housing factor fund rule. You got 5 years. And then if you expended it all, you get an additional 5 years of new funding. There are different leverage requirements. We met them every way. The first five don't have it. The second five do. During the course of this, HUD changed the rulemaking to DDTF. So we wrote letters and fought because they put a date that would have removed the funding from us. But Washington moves very slowly. So they, when they finally published the rule, they couldn't go back far enough, and they had to include us. So we are in round two now. We have five more years of this funding that's coming to us. And assuming it doesn't get cut, any cuts to the capital fund are particularly painful. It isn't the capital fund of the public housing so much as these DDTF funds that used to be replacement housing factor funds. Because of that, the funding that was thrown off from MTW that we had programmed wasn't needed. We used DDTF funds or replacement housing factor funds, and we banked those for future development activities. And that's why it grew so much. I would not anticipate that necessarily going on in the future. Okay.
But it's a good strategy.
Thank you. And I think the other great thing, since we're doing the combined budget and discussion today, that I personally am most relieved and excited about is having OPI establish their own development funds, their own development activities, being the general partner in development, and moving forward in a kind of weird, wonderful way. It's creating a very large nonprofit that's got real assets to develop out of the box, and I think it's really exciting.
Wonderful. And there's a difference in 20 staff for the capital improvement?
I don't know.
Staffing where. Levels?
Oh, the staffing levels.
Next page.
Yeah, that's the next slide. So the next slide, actually, you would think, but it isn't necessarily. So the biggest shift you will notice is between CID and actually an increase in OPO. The other ones you've heard presentations on, family and community partnerships, we've added three from vacant positions and moved them over. Michelle, a couple to facilitate that. But the biggest shift, I don't know if Mark Schiffer wants to come up real quickly and just go over some of his staffing changes, because it is something that the chair mentioned to me. I just never really could, because it's a little disconnected. There are two things going on. There's transfers of vacant positions to create new positions that we need, and then there's transfers that are people and positions of units that are going from CID to OPO. So I'll turn it over to Mark.
Good evening, Commissioners. Mark Schifferl, Director of Property Management. The positions that you see in the staffing level changes are coming over from Capital Improvements Department. We're getting the landscape crew that's coming over. We just hired a landscape manager to oversee that crew. Hired internally a 19-year employee to lead that for us. So we're excited about that. And the other remaining positions are painters that are coming over. So they will help us turn over our vacant units quicker, faster, and work with our construction and project administrator for unit renovations that we're working with in our department. So those are the exciting times for our teams this upcoming year. Cool.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
You bet.
Very cool.
Okay, that concludes our presentation.
So I just have.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Commissioner. I can wait.
I'm always wanted to double check on the big variances from one year to the next. I'm sure that you probably covered it, but I just wanted to make sure that I understood the big difference on page 8 of the authority-wide annual operating budget, excluding OP and CAHI, line 471504, housing assistance other. There's like a 92% variance. I was just curious. That's probably a shifting of something or other, right?
If it is, it's moving it somewhere else. Where were you on? You're on the year-over-year, right?
Yeah.
Year-over-year.
And what page, Commissioner? What?
Page 8, negative 92%. So that's like a big difference. I was just wondering, what is that about?
Negative 92%. So we had housing assistance other, which had 1.9 booked in 2018. And I believe it's the special programs we booked last year. Is Michelle there? I think she stepped out. We booked money to do some of the landlord incentives last year, mm-hmm. and we've moved them into a different place. So we took it from one area and moved it into another. And it ends up a large percentage because there's only 150,000 left. But I would have to have Michelle probably give us the detail.
But we're still doing the landlord incentive.
We are, and they're bulleted
it's just
out separately.
Being moved under
yeah, they're into a separate. Their
so
own
I
line
should
item.
See that shift in another.
You should.
See a
and
few
if you look
lines
at it,
below.
You can see, if you go down, you say new landlord signing bonus, new landlord recognition, mm-hmm. Building Bridges CalWIN, and Building Bridges THP Plus.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so that we've actually just broken that out.
Yeah, into specific line items rather than one.
Oh,
so you took
I
the
see.
1.9. And it became basically 1.9 if you add those together.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. The other one is, I'm sure there's a reason for this, but, you know, it's so difficult to understand these numbers, so I appreciate your patience. On page 1 of the same handout, it's a 96% difference on the subtotal of the total rental income.
That's because okay. It doesn't include OPI, right?
No,
okay.
That's because last year the way they present tenant rent is that for the third-party managed sites, instead of presenting the tenant rent by line item number, mm-hmm. they take the net. So what they did last year's budget, the way it's presented is it's the total revenue minus the total expenses gives you a net number. That number goes into other general expenses as one number rather than presenting it by line item, which we did this year. So this year we pick up revenue expenses by line item. So that's why you see the difference.
So you did it a much clearer way.
We did it the way
you broke it down
the way
it needed to
be
broken down.
The way it
down.
Should be, yeah.
I see. Okay. There wasn't a board budget committee set up, subcommittee set up this year, huh?
No, because we've kind of decided that we do that more when there's new commissioners, and everybody felt that, we just wanted to give this a try and do this one session for the whole commission for the budget, see if it works, you know. So actually, that's really, I mean, what you've said is important. I mean, if anyone thinks that this is not the best way to do it and it would be better to have a committee, just let me know.
Well, one of the priorities of this commission is to make sure that the budget, we're in charge. This is our responsibility.
That's exactly right.
And I completely trust our staff, but I also would love it if there was more time spent within a subcommittee so that we could delve deeply into it so we understand it a little bit better. And so then I could rely on that subcommittee to say, yes, we've had a more deeper understanding. We went over things and asked questions, and we recommend as a subcommittee to approve it. I just would love that kind of backup instead of being exposed to this.
You'd like to have some other people looking at it separately to get a better warm fuzzy.
Warm fuzzy, yeah. Yeah, but, I just feel like it's so important. It's so much a part of what it is that we are supposed to do.
Well, it is. Actually, risk management and financial oversight is one of the key things that we have to do.
Yes.
So, I actually feel that we've gotten a very effective presentation here myself.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like I'm comfortable with it. Yeah, but everybody really needs to be comfortable with it, and if some people are not comfortable with it, well, then we may go back and form, have committees on this, because that's what we always used to do.
Yeah, we usually had two committee meetings, some of that was going through every department, which takes time. And it was mostly to make sure that new board members understood every department, how they function, where they are. The last 2 years, this year and last year, and maybe before, I can't remember.
I think it's just been these two years. Last year was the first time, I think, that we tried this, and people thought that this actually worked pretty well. Because everybody kind of understood what we were doing, everyone here at OHA, and so the presentations have actually, I felt, they answer the questions that I have. And but then again, I've been messing with budgets and things for like a long time. So I have a different comfort level with budgets than a lot of people
do. The other reason I think that particularly last year and this year are, I think, work better. This is a budget workshop, so it's where we walk through the budget and we talk about it. And we don't take any action, which is important. And it's trying to get everybody to speak. What happened with the committee, even though you relied on them, there were always, this is a lot, I wasn't in the committee and I didn't understand it.
Yeah. Right.
And that's its own challenge. And I thought it was, particularly since we have really a group of commissioners that are well-versed on how we operate, and they're not, and learning, it's having this is anyone can attend. If you remember, we don't need a quorum. Everybody wants to know about the budget. Have any conversation about it, please come tonight. We'll go over everything. I think is a way that all the interested board members can attend rather than a select three. Mm-hmm. And it also is open to everyone where the ad hoc committee isn't. It's not a public meeting. Mm-hmm. Where this one is public and anyone can come opine on our budget. So I think there's real advantages to doing it this way.
Yes.
And I also think it's important that all the commissioners get the same information.
Well, it's also important to remember that when we were doing the committee format, we didn't do this.
Yeah.
So we would do there would be a budget presentation made to the full commission, but it would be 20, 30 minutes, whatever. Yeah. That was it. And so the reliance was actually on the people that were on the committee. And then I know that I stopped being on the committee because I wanted other people to have chances to be on the committee. But then I realized that, wait a minute, now I'm not on the committee. I'm not so plugged in as I was before. So in some ways, nothing's perfect, but there's some advantages to this approach and
absolutely
some advantages to the other approach, So,
when I first became a commissioner, I went through some trainings that impressed upon me my responsibility as a commissioner, as a steward of the finances, and so I think that's where I'm coming from, and I'm just mm-hmm. one voice. If everyone else is comfortable doing this, then
you are
totally okay.
You are absolutely on the money, because this has always been one of my top priorities. Always understanding the budget. and how is it being made, and what are the changes year to year, because that's really the meat and potatoes of the business. You know, and then we look at how we go through the year, and are we tracking off of the budget, yes or no?
Exactly.
See?
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
well, thank you.
I do appreciate the format and going through each department and doing it fairly thoroughly. I wonder if, because it does take time and you have a very, very complicated budget, mm-hmm. very complicated organization, it is nice that everyone gets to be in it. I wonder if maybe it either breaking it into two sessions where then we won't look at the clock.
Yeah, this is getting pretty intense, right?
You know, then it might give us everybody a chance to be fresh and ask all the questions
that's
we need.
And that would be very much like having a committee, only it would be two board meetings.
Yeah.
And that's totally, I think, fine with staff. We just don't want to.
We'll just make it like.
We'll do whatever this board would like to do.
Ending
in terms
with like,
of it is.
You know, eight instead of 10.
If we do it that way, I think it would be great to have it be a full board meeting, but no quorums required because we're not going to take action, so people can attend or not attend based on their schedule and interest. Because two meetings, as we've seen, we've been. Ooh.
This is two meetings.
Yeah, it is, exactly.
This is two meetings.
Right. But what I think maybe we can do is kind of figure it out next year how you want to handle it.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
We usually have, we had this rolled up early this year because of the team in front of you. And so it's just putting together the PowerPoints and talking about what we think is really important for you to know in the budget because we don't have time to go over it. Mm-hmm. It is a really complicated budget, and it is a way of moving money that is surreal, and it's expenditures that are huge. Mm-hmm. And you get people who do it every day, so they know it every day.
Right.
And it's to translate that to the world is part of the challenge.
Yeah.
And whether we can ever accomplish 100% of that is part of the challenge, but with certainly whatever time the board wants to spend on it. There isn't anyone who didn't present tonight that wouldn't be willing and happy to talk to you at length about their department and programs, I would tell you that.
Yeah.
There's no shortage of people who would have liked to present tonight. It's just I have to edit it down to the things I think are most important this year.
Right.
Knowing that we have you for one night. If we have you for two, we'll not try and make it shorter tonight, but it will still be, you know, you've been here.
What I'm now thinking is this is kind of my idea, okay, now, but based on what you said, because I think you brought up a really good comment here, that that next year, prior to starting this process, we'll put something on the agenda,
right?
We'll have something on the agenda, and it'll be like, okay, how do we want to roll?
So
do we want to go with two meetings to the whole commission? Do we want to have a committee? We can vote. We can do anything we want.
So I do think if you're going to do that, you need to do it relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Because we start our budget process in November. This has been building since November. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind. We want to make sure we factor in enough time and scheduling. So maybe if by October we have an idea.
That's fine.
You know,
we'll do it in October.
Yeah, just some conversation about how you want to do
it.
So we can be ready, because it does take a lot of work to not just prepare the budget, but also the presentation.
I think that's a good idea.
And if I could make a recommendation to actually put this piece first, so that it's easier for me to contemplate the presentations, et cetera, but this piece is so important. If we could just flip it mm-hmm. and then do the presentations afterwards, I would like to make that consideration. Just to give you the weight that you need in my undivided, unsleepy attention.
It's pretty dry.
Okay, good. I think I got a second. Thank you so much for tonight. Oh, my God. Thank you.
Yep, you've done amazing. No, I think everyone has done here a really good job of presenting a lot of complicated information in a way that us amateurs can become somewhat dangerous. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Great. So finish up the agenda on to Inez, do you want to forward that?
All right. So now we have item C. I believe there is no one here.
There are no one who wishing to address the commission.
And so now the question is, given the hour, how do we want to manage the next few things on the agenda?
The reports, the written communications monthly report is in your packet with a couple of other items. Yeah. If you have anything, any questions about her, please give me a call tomorrow. How's that?
That sounds like a heck of a cool idea.
Moving on to the director, to the next item. Inez. Okay, written communications, and that's there are several things in your packet. Please read through them.
Cool.
And again, let me know. In terms of other announcements, I went through my list. I pretty much said them all, except I want to just say our annual meeting is scheduled for June 25th. The next meeting that is actually the May meeting is June 4th. So June 4th after Memorial Day, because Memorial Day weekend, it's June 4th. And that's when this budget will come back. The annual meeting is June 25th. At the annual meeting, there will be, along with the chair and vice chair appointments, we also will look at appointments for Tessa Faranga and Opie. So just
that,
so that's...
Is that one at 5 or still 6?
No, it's 6. We fixed it, so we're good.
No,
it was at 7. It was later.
Used to
be, but it's fixed. And then we have Owner Appreciation Day, you heard, is this Saturday. And finally, on June 13th, on Wednesday, we're having the Lockwood Block Party in the afternoon.
Owner Appreciation Day is when?
Saturday, this coming Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it'll be at 1540 Webster. And that's all I have.
Thank you.
Okay, good. And then reports of commission committees. No, we didn't have any either. Nobody met, so that makes it simple. And so so do we have any announcements to make?
I just have one announcement. I want to thank you guys for allowing me to go to the NARL conference. Learned a lot, and our deputy was there with us, and I want to thank her for accompanying us to the lobbying, Congresswoman Lee. And our senator got some good input from that. And I just want to share that we also took a tour of the evicted museum. And that really emotionally got me as to seeing all the numbers of people who've been evicted. And it just kind of helped me see why the work we do is important. And it just kind of moved me to tears. California had 63,000 people who have been evicted. And when you go through the exhibit, Matthew Desmond, he has a book called Evicted. And I encourage you guys to check it out. But most importantly, it helped me see where children are concerned. And I don't know if you remember, Deputy, that we went through and we were listening to the video where the judge was there and his family was in front. And this child was sitting on the bed and he turned back and he was looking at you kind of like he said, Commissioner, help. Okay, and I started crying. You know it's crying. But that whole exhibit just helped me see how important our work is. So as we go over our budget, look at how much money we're spending. We need more housing. Everything that we're doing is so needed right now. All the encampments out on the street right now. Thank you. I know we're going to get there. I know we're going to house more people. But when I see a child in an encampment living with his family, I'm like, oh my God, what emotionally, how that child's going to be affected. And the last thing I want to say is, at the NARO conference, the secretary had mentioned that he wants to revise Section 3. Did you hear about that, Director?
Well, he's interested in Section 3.
Okay.
We already exceed Section 3. There are places,
that's my thought.
And it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because I also hear he wants to get rid of Davis-Bacon. So
yes.
He wants Section 3 and no Davis-Bacon.
Yes. Oh. I just wanted to share that. But and one last thing I want to mention. Okay, I want to thank you guys for supporting me with my mother's death. And Deputy, I want to thank you for being there with me and me sharing with you my challenges I was going through with my mom and everything I went through there. So I want to thank you for just listening and hearing me out and knowing what I was going through with my mother's loss.
So thank you again. Thank you, staff. Thank you for being here tonight, 10 o'clock. And thank you for your work. And I love you guys for what you do, because we're housing people and making a difference in our community. God bless you. Thank you.
All right, good. And I would just second some of the what Marlene was saying about this evicted exhibit. This evicted, the book, the exhibit.
Yes.
This is like not what you think.
No, it's not.
This is some dark, dark stuff that's going on to these people that is like on the level of, are you kidding me? And that's what's really going on out there. So this is... this is something important to be aware of. So anyway, now you know where to get the data. You're empowered. And now we will actually...
Hold on, because I just finished reading the book.
Oh, cool.
And that book is the story of us as well as is the story of us, because we are mentioned in it in a variety of ways. We're mentioned as the persons who exasperate eviction because it's so hard to get into our sites. And then we're turning around, we're the solution to it. So mm-hmm. It's also our story, too. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, it's cool. All right, so now we're on to item 11, adjournment. All right, so we're looking for a motion.
A motion to adjourn.
Adjourn, yes.
Yeah.
We out of here. All right.
Thank you all.
We are adjourned, and thank
everyone. Do we have a closed session?